For someone who's never had any stability, I guess I thrive under chaos, so I enjoyed it a bit too much. And so I was like, bas yahi karna hai zindagi mein.
What is the hard work that goes behind it?
A whole lot of research. There are certain times in life, or certain times during the match, not in life, but during the match, that there will be dull moments. You need to know how to fill those dull moments. The idea is to sell a story. The idea is not to just ramble and just say anything. It's to sell a story and make you believe it. Like, I can't go in and say Sachin Tendulkar debuted at 24 years old when he actually debuted at the age of 16, right?
So the highlight of your 2025 career was the Asia Cup, where you were commenting in Hindi. Mm-hmm. For the India-Pakistan finals.
Yeah, for the India-Pakistan matches, yeah.
Yeah.
I want to be on top of my game that day.
Hi, Hitesh. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
So I found a very interesting word, sportsologist, on your Instagram. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me more about it?
It's like sociology or psychology. So essentially, when we were in school, they used to teach us that it used to be broken up between socio and logos, because logos was the Greek word for study, right? Mm-hmm. So when I was coming up with witty ways to present myself over social media, I thought, why not just call myself a sportsologist as a student of sports? I mean, it's just a play on words, essentially. Nothing more than that. There's no deeper meaning to it.
Oh, shit, that's what I was hoping.
Nah, no deeper meaning. It's all fluff. It's all fluff. But yeah, since childhood, I've always been interested in sports.
Yeah.
So how I got into this and the avenues that I had to go through, eventually it just led me to realize that this is what I wanted to do, and I don't consider myself an expert, so may as well call myself a student.
Alright, that's great. You studied sociology, and you said multiple times that that has played a role in your life, personally and professionally.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that?
So, when we talk about sociology, it's the study of society, right? So, sports is also, oddly enough, a very intrinsic part of society, even though it's very vanilla. Like, it's a very surface level thing. But if you dive deep into it, you realize sports is about identity, about community, about how nowadays sometimes it's politicized. So there is a lot of sociology within sports that somehow sometimes gets overlooked, because everyone just thinks about the statistics and the players and how they're performing. But for the fans, it's a bit more than that. And that's why, perhaps, just to try and understand how the fan would feel or what would be the right way to approach something, I think that sort of comes in from that sociological aspect of the studies that I'd done when I was younger.
Yeah. So, the buy-in played a very important role when it came to you becoming a commentator.
Right? Yeah.
How? Why?
Well, it starts off with my dog. His name was Mojo, who I used to fondly call Mujinder Lal Sahani. So Mojo had one day gone down for a walk, and you know, in Delhi, in Basant Kunj, you have like a plethora of houses in one community, in one setting. And Debayan Sen happened to be my neighbor. And he took a liking to him, and his wife took a liking to Mojo, and they saw him at the walk and they decided to come up with him. And they just sat at our house and acquainted themselves to our family. And he just mentioned that he's a sports commentator. And at that point, I was a very confused child. I tried to do multiple things prior to that. I didn't know what to do, which is why I ended up doing sociology in the first place. Because kuch to degree chahiye tha na zindagi mein. Kyunki law karna chahta tha, nahi ho paya.
History bhi toh aise hi.
History, haan, but basically, essentially, just I was quite directionless, because there were plenty of directions that I could go through. Let's put it that way. That's why it was directionless. So when he mentioned this, I said, oh, this is about third year college. He said that I'm a sports commentator. I said, oh, that's interesting. And he just happened to mention that he was going for an India versus Bayern Munich match that he was going to cover in Jawaharlal Nehru Stadium that year. And he just said, why don't you come along and see what happens? So I said, okay, cool. Let me just, why not? So I went there. I sat in what's called a production control room, which is the back end of how live sports is produced or studio shows are produced. It's akin to how, if you're in a news organization, say in NDTV or in any other news outlet. You would have a production control room where there's a producer and a director and a graphics person,
yeah,
and there's utter chaos happening,
yeah,
in the background, even though everything seems so calm in front. Similarly, when it comes to sports, when it's a studio show, it's almost similar to what you see in news. But when it comes to live sports,
yeah,
there are 30 cameras. So the director is seeing 30 different things.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a graphics guy, and then,
yeah,
there's a producer, and then there's cameramen all over, and then there's something called the EVS. So it's utter chaos.
Yeah. Yeah.
And for someone who's never had any stability, I guess I thrive under chaos, so I enjoyed it a bit too,
yes,
much. And so I was like, bas, yehi karna hai zindagi mein. Little did I know that my weekends would get jacked for the rest of my life, because sports usually happens over the weekends, but it's a conscious choice that I made. And then I decided that, yeah, so then it was a horse with blinders situation, did a postgrad in journalism,
yeah,
and then interned, and then went through the rigmarole.
I mean, before I jump into other segments, I do need to point out that I myself was so-called directionless. I did history, okay, and eventually I went to work for NDTV and then studied journalism. And I just feel it also comes from the fact that we feel that if we are not in one of those three, four directions, doctor, scientist, I don't know, the few that is so culturally appropriate in India, we just feel everything else is directionless till we are put into some sort of chaotic mess and then we come out flourishing. That's the case, right?
It's easy to say that. I mean, you can look at it in different ways. I guess I was lucky enough to be born in a family that didn't really have the doctor, engineer, businessman sort of banner attached to them. Because my mom's a child rights activist.
Yeah.
My father, even though he was an investment consultant by profession, preferred to do photography or write a book or become a Tibetan Buddhist art scholar on his own. Like, he just studied it on his own. My aunt is working in Human Rights Watch. My uncle is a cinematographer. My sister is a set designer.
Yeah.
I'm getting into production. So each and every person has just chosen their own avenue, their own way,
yeah,
and tried and had the ability to find their calling. And no one really said, no,
yeah,
don't do that. In fact, I guess for my parents, it must have been a little frustrating.
Mm.
I don't know. You would have to ask them, because since childhood, first I got into sports, and then I got into music, and then I would sing on stage. So then I was like, maybe I can become a singer. Then at some point, because I was doing so well in Spanish, my dad was like, why don't you become a Spanish translator at the embassy? Which, to be honest, doesn't sound very exciting. But then look at the ideas that he was giving me, just saying, ye kar lo.
Yeah.
Or then I also thought maybe environmental law or a documentary filmmaker or maybe do something else. Every day, everything that I was exposed to, each and every avenue, because luckily the social circles were such in the Delhi that I was part of, that I was exposed to so many different people with so many different characteristics, so many different professions, that you could literally pick and choose and say, hey, this looks cool. Hey, this sounds cool. Maybe I can be that. So I guess what I do now would be an amalgamation of all the exposures that I've had in life. And it translates into what I am today.
Coming back to your commentary, we want to understand some of the BTS. We think that you just pick up a camera, pick up a mic and you start talking as if you're talking to me, but that's not what it is. So tell the audience that what is the hard work that goes behind it?
A whole lot of research. A whole lot of research. So, for example, if I'm working on a tournament, let's say, a cricket match. There are certain times in life, or certain times during the match, not in life, but during the match, that there will be dull moments. You need to know how to fill those dull moments. Now, how would you do that if you don't know anything about the players? There are 22 players. There's a coach. There's people on the bench. There are celebrities that may come in. Obviously, celebrities, someone may tell you. But just like little statistics about them, or fun facts about each and every player, or their journeys. You know, it's... The idea is to sell a story. The idea is not to just ramble and just say anything. It's to sell a story and make you believe it. So if I'm telling you about a certain player, or if I'm telling you a factoid about somebody else, then I have to be sure that I'm telling you the correct thing. I don't want to spread misinformation. Even though it's not as perhaps as important or as grave digging as misinformation on a larger scale, but from my standpoint also, I don't want to misinform the viewer and say something wrong. Like, I can't go in and say Sachin Tendulkar debuted at 24 years old when he actually debuted at the age of 16, right? Mm. So one has to do all that research. So what I end up doing is I create cheat sheets. Mm. So each and every player will have his name, his age, his batting position, or if it's football, where he plays, how many times he's played for the country, if it's a football match, what club he plays for, what are their statistics through the season, what are the fun stories that I've managed to dig up through articles, and I'll just create like a little block for them in an Excel sheet, and then the next player, and then the next player, and then the next player, and then it can become an exhaustive list. So if I'm working on, say, a FIFA World Cup, which has 32 teams, so then 32 teams, all of them, each player, so a squad of 25, so I don't know math, because I'm clearly, which is why I'm doing what I'm doing, as opposed to, getting into something more academic. So say 25 teams and 25 players, 32 teams, it's a lot of data. So it's just deep diving into as much as you can so that you can ensure that there is no dull moment and that you're entertained as you watch the broadcast.
So is there something you do for voice as well in training?
So oddly enough, I'll be honest, I haven't done it, but I would encourage someone who would want to go into something like this to do it. Again, as I said, I was lucky enough to have done so many things when I was younger.
Yeah.
So I used to sing on stage in this. I was part of this choir group in Delhi called Artists Unlimited.
Yeah.
So in that, that probably honed my vocal skills a bit. So because they would teach you how to sing with bravita, so talk through your tummy or do things like that. So I myself personally have never practiced any vocal coaching. As far as the diction is concerned or language, just read.
Okay.
Read as much as you can, whatever language you wish to. And for me, one of the things that I try to do on a personal level, which is not the case that most people would like to do, I like to be creative, I like to be poetic, I like to challenge myself into being able to say something differently each time. So that it doesn't sound the same.
Mm-hmm.
So that it doesn't sound repetitive. So that it doesn't sound like it's just going through the motions. So those will only come if you read or you have that creative license or you believe you can imbibe that creative license within you to be able to project it that way.
As someone who's been in the industry for almost a decade now, the then and now of people perceiving sports because of digitalization, how has that changed? How have you viewed the graph?
So, digitalization, or digitization, whichever, I don't know which one is the correct term, but with the coming of OTTs, it's just become more accessible. Because now, earlier, if you remember, let's go back, like time immemorial. First, there was community-driven, where everyone from, because there was only one TV in a mohalla, then everyone used to come to watch that one television. Then if it used to get kharab, someone would have to go up to the roof, fix the antenna, come back down, oh, TV's on. Liberalization came in, color TV came in, every household had one television. That changed the landscape a little bit. This is just yet another step in that direction, wherein now, on the go, people can just sit and watch something on their screen.
Mm.
So the accessibility has increased.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the amount of sports that can be consumed has increased. That doesn't necessarily translate into anything that changes for me. My work remains the same. But
with like social media coming in, what I'm trying to understand is that if you're doing it directly for TV, it's one particular thing.
Mm.
But then when you know ke, for example, iska to reel katna hai, then you will talk a certain way because now that becomes a talk.
I wouldn't. And that's why that's why I'm not very good at social media.
Okay.
Unfortunately, that's probably one bane of my existence. I would think so.
Mm-hmm.
Is that some people look? There are two ways. Like when it comes to live, when I focus on live sports, my idea is to present it as live sports. I'm not thinking about social media at that point. Social media is a different avenue altogether.
Mm-hmm.
Social media has influencers, and social media has different language, and social media has a different vibe to it, which is more catchy, where the attention span of a person is different. But that's not live sports. Live sports will remain live sports till time immemorial, or since time immemorial and for the future.
Mm-hmm.
It will, I mean, a cricket match will still remain 50 overs. Social media cannot change that.
Yeah.
What can change is the number of people who are giving their opinion on that cricket match. match. Mm-hmm. What can change is the number of highlights that you see on that cricket match. So either which way, if someone's hitting a six, I will try with the best of my abilities to come up with the best words either way, mm-hmm. whether it's for television or whether that only that little sixer has been clipped mm-hmm. for social media.
Digitalization hasn't really affected your job in many ways.
I would hope not, but
yeah, till now.
My job, you'd have to ask the channels or the producers.
Okay.
But I do see that certain people, like, it depends on the avenue that you take, because I took a very old school route to get to this stage, but there are a lot of people who've come through social media to get to this stage. So a lot of influencers, for example, are now on television as anchors.
Yeah.
Because they used Instagram so well
that
someone saw it and they were like, this fellow has a TV presence. So then they called that person in and then they trained them into television, and therefore now they do both. But the language skills and the and the thought process and the way it's done is very different. Because when you're doing live television, there is someone talking to you in your ear constantly. You're constantly engaging with the person next to you. You're looking at the visuals that are happening. That's one way. Now, if I'm anchoring a show, then there's a producer who's constantly rattling something in my ear. Then there are experts and guests who I'm talking to, whose answers I have to listen to. I have to be conscious of the camera. I have to be conscious of what's coming next, if there's a graphic that's on air. So the hygiene of all of it is so different in a live setup that you can't really compare it to what happens on social media. Yes, someone who's good on social media can translate those skills into live, but that's not the case necessarily, nor is the case that someone who's good at live will be good at social media. It's not necessary that they cross connect.
So, like you said, influencers. I think the sports culture now, as well as all the other cultures, are bringing in influencers when it comes to promoting sports as well. Like either they bring them as guests and they ask them to promote, or there's some sort of a collaboration in real form or something. Do you think that that is decreasing or increasing the quality of the way sports is taken in?
No, it's just different. It's just different. Look, you have to get with the times. You have to understand what's going on. Now, if a 14-year-old has an access to a cell phone, and unfortunately that their exposure, they've only been brought up in a world of social media, that's how they consume media. So you can't look down upon it. You can't say, this is wrong and this is right. It's just another form of social media. So if a channel is bringing in an influencer to promote a particular event, that's because they realize that there is some meat to that matter, right? That doesn't mean that channel is lowering its standards. No. It's just another way of marketing a particular event. Now, tomorrow, if you want the people to watch, say, an Indian football match, which doesn't get as much reach, why wouldn't you then tap into someone who's a social media influencer who has millions of followers, who can go and say, listen, let's watch this Indian football match because the team needs our support? I am not averse to that idea at all, because at least it'll get more eyeballs, it'll get more exposure. And social media, again, the same way how OTTs have made it so easy for sports to be accessible, social media has connected everyone in the world. Yes, it has its bane's. Yes, it has its problems. And people can get into it. I'm no expert in that. You can watch documentaries on it. But the fact that it can reach more people in an instant, accept it. I try myself as much as I can to use it.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't I?
And in this 10-year-long experience of yours, what is the one person or an incident from sports that you feel has changed your thinking completely in some way or the other, for the better or for the worse?
I wouldn't say it would be an instance. Actually, one person, apart from Debayan, the other person I give credit to a lot is this guy called Anant Tyagi. Because when I first started out, he was the one that trained me. When I was working at Star Sports, I was behind the scenes, I was a producer. And he, along with the football team, along with my boss there, Gaurav Gala, they believed that they could give me a chance and an opportunity. And then he trained me a lot. So I give him a lot of credit, obviously. But I guess what was very important for me, as I said, I had a very old school approach, was that I worked a lot behind the scenes. I wanted to understand the industry. I wanted to understand what it takes to actually weave a narrative in a certain way. I didn't want to look for a quick fix. So for 5-6 years, I wrote scripts, did voiceovers, sat on edit tables, you know, just made highlights packages, reported to bosses, was underpaid, overworked, even though other people might say, hey, but yeah, completely, in my opinion, completely underpaid and overworked. But I don't mind it, because that was the foundation that helped me hone my skills, if at all I have any, to reach where I am, if at all I have reached anywhere.
Yeah, okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. But did you have a fanboy or fangirl moment with someone?
Did I ever have? I honestly have not. I'll be honest, have not.
In 10 years?
No, because I've never been a person that's very starstruck. And it's my profession. The moment it's your profession, you only dilute your... This was the thought process that I've always come up with.
Yeah.
You dilute your own representation in the other person's eyes.
Absolutely.
If you end up being a fanboy.
Yeah.
If I'm meeting a Virinder Sehwag and I'm commentating with him, if I go up to him prior to that and say, sir, big fan, sir, big fan, sir.
Yeah.
What will he think?
Yeah, absolutely. But in your heart or mind, you'll be like,
no.
Butterflies, I've met this
person. No. I guess it just gets conditioned. What was exciting initially was, ooh, I'm interning. My first internship
Star
was... My first thing was, ooh, I'm interning in the IPL. Ooh, I've got a job with Star Sports. Those things were sort of like... But once you're within that system, then you're seeing these people everywhere. Mm-hmm. Like, then you're working with them. You're giving them their scripts. You're actually... working with them or working for them or things like that, then at that point you can't be a fanboy. Then that just dilutes your professionalism.
Mm-hmm.
So I've tried not to be starstruck, and I think that's just become a part of my personality now.
So the highlight of your 2025 career was the Asia Cup, where you were commenting in Hindi for the India-Pakistan finals.
Yeah, for the India-Pakistan matches, yeah.
Yeah. Was it the only India-Pakistan matches, or was it just...
No, I did the entire tournament,
up
till a week prior to the end of the tournament. But yeah, it was a fascinating experience, especially the India-Pakistan game, because the second India-Pakistan game was the one where it... The first one was the one where all the scandal had a little broken out, where the no handshake had happened.
Yeah.
And then to then do this match, or to just have that experience in itself, was pretty surreal, because there was more, somehow suddenly more was riding on the game as opposed to just cricket, which is, in my opinion, a little unfortunate, because I'm a firm believer that one should
sportsmanship,
keep...
Sportsmanship,
it should just be a little... But then, it is what it is. It happened.
Yeah, but what I want to understand is that, is it any different to work for an India-Pakistan match compared to all the others?
You understand the scale. Yeah, you understand the scale of it.
Yeah.
I mean, for example, on that day particularly, so I have a tendency on the days where I feel like I need to pump myself up more, or I really need to kill it, I listen to a lot of heavy metal or something like that to just, you know, get into this. So I ended up doing that because I understood that there's more gravitas to this event as opposed to commentating on a Bangladesh versus UAE match. Or an Afghanistan versus Sri Lanka match. Obviously, an Afghanistan versus Sri Lanka match is not as important in India as an India versus Pakistan match. So, you really want to be on your A game.
Yeah.
So, do you feel a little nervous? Maybe. But at the same time, you develop your own techniques to...
Is there something different that you do work-wise when it comes to, like, maybe what kind of... the way, the tonality... of your commentary becomes a certain way for these matches?
No, but I certainly do try harder to be more creative.
Okay.
I'd certainly be a little more upright in terms of my thought process.
Mm.
Maybe not in my body language, but in terms of my thought process, for sure. Mm. I want to be on top of my game that day, a bit more. Some games you can, I mean, it's easy to say you're on top of a game for every event that you do, every single day, but that's not the case, right? At the end of the day, it's a performance.
Mm-hmm.
It's a live performance each time that you're working on something.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if I'm anchoring the French Open final, then I want to be on the top of my game on the French Open final day as opposed to the first day of the French Open.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually, no, first day also you want to be, but midway through the French Open...
You're like, okay, it's average-ish.
No, it's not, you'd never want to be average.
Okay.
You'd never want to be
sorry,
average.
Sorry, I take that back.
Yeah, you should.
Yeah.
But you'd want to ensure that even if you're striving for excellence, you go beyond. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way.
Okay. And how have you seen the sports audience grow over the years? Or have you seen it as well or not?
I mean, social media can give you a sort of outlook on this. Because there's more television, because there's more access, so the audience has definitely grown.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened though is that there is a clear divide between one sport and the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And that needs to be bridged somehow. It hasn't happened yet,
yeah.
Even though people have tried, but it hasn't happened. Mm-hmm. And that's something that flummoxes anybody and everybody in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
It's cricket is the money maker. There's no, it's not a secret. Everything else is way, way far behind in terms of the numbers that it procures, or in terms of the money that's spent on it, or in terms of the viewership that comes into it as well.
But over the years, do you think that the style is changing because of what people want to hear, or the way?
Oh, definitely. Oh, in terms of how we do it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, but that's also because the media in itself has changed. Of course. As the industry grows, of course, there's a difference in how it's been presented.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier, it used to be Doordarshan.
Mm.
Right? Mm. So, Doordarshan style was very different.
Yeah.
And then it evolves. The same way television has evolved, of course, the style of commentary and all has also evolved. So, the example that I could give you that's very clear in my head would be, say, a football thing. So if you ever sit and watch the old time English football matches and the way someone's commentating there, it's very plain Jane, it's very matter of fact, they're following the ball, they're trying to do something else. But if you now go into a football match, a big football match nowadays, you have this commentator called Peter Drury, who's adding his own little masala into everything that he says. He's trying to be more poetic, he's trying to It's not only about, oh, what a goal.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the greatness of the goal. Yeah. Or it's about... So it's very easy. So, for example, something that I would say. Say in Hindi, say in that India-Pakistan match. On the first ball itself, Abhishek Sharma was up against Shaheen Shah Afridi.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the first ball of the Indian innings where they're chasing. Shaheen Shah Afridi hits a short ball. Abhishek Sharma pulls it and goes for six. Now, back in the day perhaps, or I'm not saying that's wrong, or I'm not saying it's correct, I'm not saying...
Just different.
It's different. They could have just said, oh, pehli ball par chhakka, kya shurwaat hai? Whereas I said something along the lines of, aur Abhishek Sharma ne is chamkili raat mein ek aur tara jod diya hai, pehli hi gend par. So, you just add your own little pizzazz, you know?
Yeah, I get it.
So, just a little wah-wah boom that you think can... So, yeah, that perhaps has happened as the industry has developed. It's not only me. Everyone strives to do something like that because, after all, that's the evolution of any industry, right? The fashion industry, the clothes that they had 20 years ago are not the clothes that you have today, no?
Yeah, not even 2 years ago.
Ha, so everything evolves, right? So, that way, even yours... Acting has also evolved, no, over time.
Absolutely.
So all industries, all performances evolve. So this has also evolved like that.
Something I want to venture into is the YouTube channel that you started.
Yeah.
I think it was very interesting because not only were you giving facts like the rare moments of sports there, but you were also talking about something called superstition in sports.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is something which is very, very ingrained in our culture. Ek taang pe khade aur unhone chakka mara to puri match ek taang pe khade rehna hai. So what are some experiences that you've noticed from the side of the sportsmen or sportswomen that you can share with us?
From my research that I did for that particular piece in itself, I can tell you a lot. See, superstitions are ingrained within sports people because these are high pressure environments, right? These are such high pressure environments. The focus of the world is on you, especially in the biggest of stages. So it's very important for them to center themselves, which is why they come up with their own routines to center themselves. Rafael Nadal famously will always arrange his bottles a certain way. or he will never step on the lines of the tennis court. He will always hop over them.
Mm-hmm.
Or those are the ones, so those are absolute superstitions, and those also just get ingrained within you. And then there are some which are not really superstitions per se, but they are things that will help you get into a rhythm. Similarly, for Rafael Nadal, for his getting into rhythm, he will bounce his ball five times, then he'll flip his hair like that, then he'll bounce again. But that's trying to get into a rhythm. That's very different. Whereas these ones become excuses. Like famously, Serena Williams once said that she lost a match because she didn't tie her right shoe first after her left, because usually she always ties her right shoe first. Sachin Tendulkar was known to put only one pad first, a particular leg, and then the second one. Those are superstitions because those are not really adding to the performance. But if Virat Kohli goes and does this after every ball, and then he goes, because that he's centering himself, he's going, and then he's going. That is different. That is something to get yourself into rhythm. So it can be bifurcated in two. Some are completely irrational. Like those are literally akin to Kali Billi Rasta Kaat Gayi. Some are completely akin to Kali Billi Rasta Kaat Gayi, and others are actually things that help you get into a rhythm.
But when you have so much pressure and you're so-called like carrying the burden or the pressure of the entire country, I think, isn't it just fair to have it?
I guess. That's what I'm saying. To each their own. I'm not...
Yeah.
Do I find it odd that Rafael Nadal would put the bottles like that? There's this match where Lucas Rosol, one player, actually kicked one of his bottles just to annoy him. You know, but it didn't really affect the match. He won eventually, no. But I guess you get so used to that habit of of being a certain way, and you think that the result will be affected if this doesn't happen. I guess, and it just happens over time. You should ask an athlete. An athlete would say it is based on that one performance, that one day. Because us din pe ye aise hua tha, now I'm going to stick to that. So, when they pick that up, I can't tell you, but superstition is intrinsic in sports for sure, 100%.
What is the one fact that you feel is a misunderstanding that the Indian culture have about sports?
What is the one misunderstanding that Indian culture has about sports? That is a man's game, mostly.
Okay.
Because if you go onto the streets, even now, it's mostly men. If you go into the industry, it's changing, even behind the scenes. It's changing slowly, but it's mostly men.
No, it's interesting because yesterday I was at some restaurant here and they were playing the
women's cricket World Cup match. So that's what I'm saying. So it's changing.
Very interesting.
It is changing.
Yeah.
And you have to give credit to Smriti Mandana, Harmanpreet Kaur, because there have been Indian female cricketers who've done really well prior to that as well. Diana Edulji has been there. Reema Malhotra has been there. They have carried the Indian flag and waved it proudly. But the exposure that Harmanpreet Kaur got because of her 170 few World Cups ago, that changed everything. That completely, that was a watershed moment, a harbinger moment for women's cricket. Because in a World Cup semi-final, she scored 170. So from there, it just exploded a little bit more. But just on the streets, if you see very few girls playing. Yes, around Bombay and Bandra, sometimes, like I'm part of this it's not co-ed because it's not really educational, but it's basically mixed gender, mixed sexes football group. So yes, girls and boys play together, but it's few and far between, and probably that also is a little privileged. But if I go onto the streets on the side, not so much, right? So that's the only, I think that's one perception that needs to change. Or the second one is that perhaps when it comes to that, there are more sports in this country, especially apart from the Big C, right? Because the gulf in terms of our exposures from cricket and everything else is exponential. It's just so wide, the margin. Luckily, people like Neeraj Chopra have come up and he wins that Olympic gold. So now people
little bit,
know a wee bit about that, about javelin or some football. Or something
things
or the
like
other.
That,
but it's just, it's still, there is a gulf. There is a clear gulf. So those are the two things that I would say that need to...
Who's your favorite sportsman?
My
or
favorite
sportswoman?
My favorite sportsman or sportswoman? Ooh.
So hard.
That's a tough one.
I have two.
That's because... Okay, who are yours?
So Nadal.
Okay.
And Chicharito.
Why Chicharito?
I don't know, he's just been my favorite.
Let this be your answer only then. No. He was a right winger
when I was a right winger. And then we both had the same number, 14.
Ah.
Yeah.
For the life of me, I can't think of anybody like that. But
yeah.
I can say there are few people that I admire, for sure. I admire Novak Djokovic's resilience, his fitness, his approach, his thought processes. I really am a huge fan of Virat Kohli's commitment, if you're talking about modern sports, in terms of achievements. What Jesse Owens did back in the Berlin Olympics, Jesus, who can ever top that?
Mm-hmm.
That is admirable.
Okay.
Being a black man coming to Nazi Germany
and
just creating
that history.
So that if you say favorite sportsman,
you could
just talk about different stories.
Very
I could talk about the Fosbury flop. How about how a physics teacher completely changed the sport. Because he went into the high jump. He was a physics teacher.
Yeah.
Right? And he just realized that, maybe this is not the way you should jump. And he created a new technique and won an Olympic gold. When he had no athletics background. Is he my favorite sportsman?
Could be.
Narratives and stories are what matter. And each sports person has their own individual journey. And you can connect with anything or everything. So I don't know if I could ever tell you if I have a favorite sportsman. I'm a sportsologist.
Okay. That's great. You mix everything.
Full circle.
Yes. What is the one advice that you'd like to give to anybody who wants to go beyond the border?
Don't cross it.
No,
I'm kidding. I'm
so
kidding.
Mean.
I'm kidding. No. Look, I don't know what the border is for anybody. Because everyone has their own threshold, has their own limits. You just have to try and push it. So, for example, for what I see, how I look at my own self is that I'm always trying to break my own glass ceilings that I create for myself. Whether it be within my workspace or my personal life or my social life, I like to meet different kinds of people. I don't want to be stuck within the same friend group. Try and expose myself to as many different kinds of people as possible. Similarly with work, I don't want to just be hamstrung in one particular avenue. Try and push those boundaries. So whatever your glass ceilings are, just try and shatter them as much as you can.
Thank you so much for coming on my podcast.
Cheers.
Thank you so much for staying until the end. To help us continue these conversations, please subscribe on YouTube and like and follow on Instagram and Spotify.